Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 13.
Hey everybody, on today's show I'm going to be talking to John Bardos from JetSetCitizen.com about what it's like to own an English language school here in Japan. みなさんこんにちは。ようこそ東京ポッドキャストへ。ホストのアンソニー・ジョーです。How's that? My Japanese language teacher has challenged me to speak more Japanese on my show as practice. My Japanese level right now is very, very beginner. You have to bear with me, but I will try to follow my teacher's instructions and try to pepper my shows with a little bit more Nihongo in the future. Anyways, I'm Anthony Joe, and you're listening to Tokyo Podcast episode number 13. Then today's show, I'm going to be talking to John Bardos, who runs a website called JetSetCitizen.com. And his site is all about living a location-independent lifestyle. If you've read Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Work Week, I'm sure you're familiar with this term. It's kind of a trendy topic right now about living outside of the office, on the road, and using what skills you have to earn an income. So I'll be talking to him about his website. But what's interesting about John is that he was an owner of an English language school here in Japan for over 10 years. He started a very successful school, and after 10 years, he decided to sell it and move on to the road and live this location-independent lifestyle. So I'm going to be talking to him about what it was like running a language school in Japan, what were some of the challenges, what are some tips that he offers for people who are looking to come to Japan to teach English, and also what it's like now for him being on the road and not tethered to his business like he was before. So that's coming up a little bit later on the show. But first, I have a little bit of housekeeping I have to do. I received an email from one of the audience members who pointed out that I have never introduced myself or explained my background as to why I am doing this in any of my shows. And I kind of went back to the archives, and he's right. I talked a little bit about the format of the show and what the show is going to be about in Tokyo Podcast episode number 1, but I've never really explained why I'm here in Japan and why I'm doing this. And he was actually surprised to find out that I've only been in Japan for 2 months. And that's true. I came here in October. So, and the reason why I kind of missed on this is that I'm not trying to be secretive or anything. It's just that I've been actually podcasting for quite a while now. I was living in, before Japan, I was living in Bangkok, Thailand for about 3 years. And during that time, I ran Bangkok Podcast with my co-host Greg Jorgensen, and we produced over 70 shows interviewing all sorts of people in Thailand. And so for me, when I came here just to switch over to Tokyo Podcast, wasn't that strange. It just felt like a kind of natural extension of what I'd been doing in Thailand. And I kind of forgot that the audience for Tokyo Podcast is brand new to me and may not have known about my history at Bangkok Podcast. So actually, on today's show, my interview with John Bardos, because him and I have very similar backgrounds in the way that we ran our businesses and how we decided to transition that, you'll hear a little bit more about my background and kind of where I came from. But thanks for the comment. My background is really not that unique. I've been in Japan now for 2 months. You know, I'm half Japanese, half Canadian, and I used to live in Japan when I was a child. I lived in Oita when I was 6 years old to 9 years old. I went to a Japanese school. I was the only gaijin in my whole school. And I've always wanted to live back in Japan. I think many hafus kind of feel that longing. You know, you Japanese have such a group mentality. I think it's just built into our DNA that even when we're half, we have the need to get back to the hive, you know? So I've always wanted to live in Japan, and I was living in Thailand for a few years, and that was a lot of fun, but I decided that, you know, it was time for me to wrap up there and move to Japan. So I'm here right now. I've been here for 2 months. I absolutely love it. It's been better than I expected, and I am really looking forward to settling down here for the long haul. And the reason why I started the podcast was that I've been an expat now for quite a number of years. I sold my business in 2007, so I've been on the road for almost 4 years, almost 5 years now, and I've lived in various countries around Asia and around Europe. And I always found that when you're an expat in a foreign country, I always find meeting other expats interesting, because most of them have an interesting story as to why they're there. Not all of them, of course, but most of them have some kind of story or background as to why they left their home country and why they're living in a new country. And I really enjoyed meeting those kind of people and hearing about what their deal is, what their story is, what they're doing. For example, I have a friend in Thailand who he writes for a couple of tennis magazines. And so he has this really cool job where he gets flown around the world to go to all the tennis matches around the world and write articles about the matches. And he gets to interview many of the famous tennis players. And the thing is, the tennis circuit, the tournaments are not all year round. They're only like in a few months out of the year. So he said, well, I could live in cold, rainy, miserable UK for most of the year, or I could live in nice, sunny, warm Thailand where it's a lot cheaper, and then just go to work, you know, for 6 months out of the year. So that's what he did. He's got a fantastically huge place in Thailand, and he has a really nice life. And something like that is something I never would have met him. I never would have even known about that kind of job exists. So I really enjoy meeting other expats and hearing their story. And the podcast allows me an opportunity to share that story with a wider audience. And I feel that as an expat, it's very easy sometimes to get stuck in a very small circle of friends. It's very easy to kind of form your little group around you and not expand beyond that. So my goal with the podcast is to kind of grow a community around it of both expats and Japanese, because one of the goals with Bangkok Podcast is I wanted to bridge the gap between the expat community and the Thai community in Bangkok. And I hope to do the same here. I want interesting people on the show, both Japanese and Gaijin, and so we can both kind of learn a little bit about, you know, what each other's lives are like and what we're all doing here on this little tiny island. So that's kind of explains a little bit about me and a little bit about this show, and I hope, sir, that answers your question. I also want to say that if you are interested in coming on the show, if you're interested in being a guest, if you got some kind of interesting story that you want to share, feel free to contact me. You can visit my website at tokyo-podcast.com, or you can visit my Facebook page at facebook.com/tokyopodcast, or I'm even on Twitter, as they say in Thailand, they say Twitter, at twitter.com/tokyopodcast. How do they say Twitter in Japanese? Twitter? I don't know. Hey, send me an email. Tell me how they say Twitter in Japanese. In Thai, it's Twitter. But anyways, yeah, visit my website, tokyopodcast.com, or check me out on Facebook or Twitter. And if you guys can all do me a favor, I'd really appreciate it if you could leave a comment or a rating on iTunes. How iTunes places you is solely done by rating and comments. So when people are searching through iTunes, shows that are commented or rated rank higher than shows that are not. So even if you hate the show, because I noticed a couple of you ranked me 1 star, even if you hate the show and you rate it 1, that will actually push my show higher up in the iTunes ranking. So if you're listening to the show, and whether you hate it or whether you like it, I would really appreciate it if you could log into your iTunes app and give me a rating or a star or feedback on the iTunes store. That's it for housekeeping. All finished. Let's get to John. Today I'm talking to Mr. John Bardos, who runs a website called JetSetCitizen.com. And this site is all about what it's like to live a location-independent lifestyle. He interviews many people who've managed to leave their 9-to-5 jobs and live abroad using computers and technology to fund their lifestyle. Today we're going to talk to him about what his life is like living an independent lifestyle, and also what it was like for him when he lived in Japan running an English language school for over 10 years. Hey, John, welcome to the show.
Hey, Anthony, thank you for having me.
Now, I first came across your site a long time ago when I was thinking about moving to Japan, and I found your website called youcanteachenglish.com.
Right.
And on this site, you have a whole bunch of information about how to get English teaching jobs, not only in Japan, but all around the world.
Yes, like I tried to create a collection of articles. The big issues that people have for seeking English teaching jobs around the world are visas, cost of living, and just getting general information about the country. So I created a website that had articles about teaching English all around the world.
Now, can you tell us, what is your background? You were living in Japan for 10 years and you weren't a teacher, but you owned a school. Is that correct?
I started as a teacher. I was a teacher for about a year or a year and a half. And then I opened up my own school. So I was actually in Japan for 14 years.
Wow, 14 years. That's a long time. What brought you to Japan originally? Why did you want to come here?
Well, back in the 80s, Japan used to be the biggest business country in the world. They were buying buildings in New York and Japanese companies were hugely successful. So I studied Japanese business practices in university and I always wanted to come to Japan. But basically the decision came down. I just was in kind of a dead end situation and I made a plan to come and I bought a ticket. And 1 week later, I was in Japan with no visa and basically no money. I just needed a change and I thought Japan was the place to do it.
Where were you from originally?
I am from Calgary, Canada.
And so what year was it that you came to Japan?
I guess I believe 1997.
Wow. And what was Japan like at that time? Because by that point in time, the Japanese juggernaut of business, shall we say, wasn't as strong.
That's right. Yes. So it was still good. And I think it still is good. I don't think it's changed much. Like, Japan has been stagnating for like three decades now, basically, right? But stagnating in Japan is very different than stagnating in other countries because Japanese have so much money.
Right.
So the savings rate is so high. So being poor in Japan is very different than being poor in the US. For example, people weren't losing their houses and it wasn't the same type of situation as it is in the US right now. So when I arrived there, like, their jobs were plentiful and it was a very rich and affluent country, just like it is now. Like, obviously the earthquake had some extra damage to the country, but basically Japan is a very resilient country and there's lots and lots of money there. I think even in the stagnation they've experienced for the last three decades.
Do you think there's still a lot of opportunities in Japan today as there was back in 97?
I think there's lots of opportunities because it might be stereotypical, but Japanese are not very entrepreneurial yet. It's changing and you're seeing more entrepreneurial type of people coming, but still the Japanese people in themselves, the idea of getting out and starting your own business is still kind of a foreign concept. So I think there are many opportunities in that way because Japanese do have a lot of money and there's such appreciation for quality food, art, and culture. So you can do some pretty high-end things and get a good audience for that, I think.
What was your first job when you first got here?
Actually, I was there, of course, like when I came without a visa, so I was illegal. So I did a whole bunch of illegal part-time jobs. I worked in a bar and I taught under the table in a small little English school that wasn't even registered or wasn't even a legitimate school. And I did a few little projects like that. A couple of them I got burned on and didn't get paid, but the other ones worked out well. And I worked for one company for a long time, even it was all under the table. Basically, I just did a whole bunch of jobs and then things started lining up. And then I finally applied for a big English chain so I could get my work visa. And then when that came through, I had to leave the country and come back. And then I was working for one of the big English chains for maybe 3 or 4 months before I quit and just started working part-time and started teaching my own part-time classes and then eventually started my school.
What was it like? What was it like for you, like, teaching English? Is that your background in Canada?
No, my background was business. I had no idea what it was like to teach English, and I think many foreigners are in that position when they go there. So I had no idea what to expect. So basically, it was just following the teacher's manual in the textbook. It says step one, say this. Step two, do this. Step three, do this. And it was basically just reading the list. And I think that's what a lot of teachers do when they first start.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that even though if you're a native speaker, teaching your own language can actually be a rather difficult experience.
It was difficult for me. I had no idea what to do and I was very nervous. You don't know what to say and what to do, but it comes pretty quickly, right? And after you get more experience and you start seeing that the students get mixed up in the same places and they need this kind of vocabulary in this situation and you start anticipating what they need. That's what makes you a good teacher. Right. But in the beginning, it was just following. Basically, textbooks are pretty simple. They have like a dialogue and vocabulary and a little story you read, and it's, you just follow the steps, and it's broken down pretty good if you use a textbook.
How long did you do that for before you started your own school?
Well, I guess it was about a year or so altogether. And when I started my own school, I was still working part-time on the side because we didn't have money, that much money coming in. We started part-time the school.
Right.
So we kind of slowly built both up at the same time.
What was your intention when you came here to stay in Japan long-term? Because, you know, many English teachers come for a year or two and then move on.
Well, a lot of teachers come for a year or two and say they're going to be leaving in the next year, but stay forever as well, too. And
oh, really?
I was kind of one of those people because the salaries are very good. The lifestyle is great. You're treated really well. The quality of food is fantastic. There's so much culture. There's so much history. It's a difficult country to leave, in fact, I would say.
Right. What was it like starting your school? Because I don't think many foreigners actually do that, do they? They end up teaching for most of their time here. But you ended up starting your own school.
Well, there are many foreign-owned schools, too. It's just a different community than the ones that are teaching for the big Eikaiwas, the big English schools.
Right.
So there's a huge expat community of school owners. So like there are many, many foreign school owners. So it's not a very difficult or novel thing to do for a foreigner. But basically, like you get to a stage, like if you don't commit to doing something, you're going to be locked into a salary of somewhere around 250,000 to 300,000 yen a month, which right now is maybe $2,300 a month US.
Right.
So, and it's and like you start at the top and you finish at the top, right? There's no way to move up because there isn't the budget to keep increasing your salary. Like you're not going to be making $5,000 or $6,000 a month if you stay with the same company for 10 years, right?
Right.
So the only way to improve your living conditions and working conditions is to start your own school. So if your plan is to stay long term, then starting your own school, I would say, is the best choice for everyone.
Was it difficult for you to do that, starting a business here? You said Japan's not a very entrepreneurial country. Is there a lot of red tape and bureaucracy that you have to deal with when you're starting a school?
There is a little bit of bureaucracy, but actually we started like under the table as well. Like our school started in rented community centers and also teaching out of a room in an old crappy apartment I had. So when we started, it's not difficult at all. Like people run businesses out of apartments and houses and community centers. So in Japan, it's very normal, that kind of stuff. So I don't think it's difficult at all. Once you start getting legal and you start paying taxes and stuff, there's a little more bureaucracy, but it's not so bad and taxes are low.
Right.
So I think it's just the culture is not entrepreneurial. The red tape and bureaucracy is not so onerous if you have someone Japanese to help you through it.
And how long did you run your school for?
I think just over 10 years it was.
10 years, eh? Wow. And what was the biggest challenge for you in running your school?
I would say like finding good foreign teachers is pretty difficult. That would probably be it doesn't sound so nice. And maybe if your other English teachers listening to this might not like this, but so much. But the quality of English teachers in Japan is not so good generally.
Right.
They're people that just want to come for a short time and travel, and they're just there for a good time. So to find a good teacher that actually cares about teaching and that's professional about teaching is actually quite hard. And it was extra hard for us because we were kind of in a rural location.
Right.
So, like an English school, we can't afford to pay $5,000 or $7,000 salaries. Like I was saying before, like the salary range is somewhere between $2,200 to $2,500 a month.
Right.
So for that price, it's difficult to get experienced, talented people that are going to stay for a while. That was definitely the biggest challenge.
And for someone, say someone's listening to this and they are thinking about coming to Japan and teaching English, what would you look for? Like, you're obviously looking for someone who's really good, but if you could give someone like a quick guide of what you would look for to hire them, what would that be?
Honestly, it's like, it's kind of ridiculous. The kind of things that I would say is like, I would say like proofread your emails that you're sending to the school to make sure there's no spelling mistakes. Show up with clean clothes, come to work on time, right? Just do basic things. People don't even like most foreigners when they get there, it's such a party culture. You go out drinking all weekend and then you miss the next 2 days of work, right? That's what generally happens. So, people just show up to work and care a little bit is all that's needed really, because it's not rocket science. If you're there in clean clothes and a haircut, right? You can be a decent English teacher, I think.
Yeah, I experienced the same thing when I ran my auto detailing business in Vancouver. I would do a lot of hiring during the spring and summer months when it was busy. And I was always surprised at the people who showed up to the interviews and just how clued out they were about what was happening. You know, I had people show up in shorts and t-shirt, no resume, no nothing, nothing prepared. And I had one guy, once he showed up with his handwritten resume that was folded in half, like folded many times, and he pulls it out of his pocket and kind of tries to smooth it out, hands it to me, and it's written in all in Spanish. And I mean, this is Vancouver. There's more Chinese than there are Spanish in Vancouver. And then he asked me, oh, you don't speak Spanish? I said, what? No, neither do any of my customers.
Yeah.
So it is kind of... It sounds strange, but as a business owner, it really is true that really the ones who are just clean cut, you know, just add a 10% professionalism to what you do, you really stand out a lot from everyone else.
Yeah, I agree. That's exactly right. I don't know what's going on in the world now, but people just don't have any basic concept of professionalism. Just showing up to work on time in clean clothes is basically all you need to do to teach English in Japan.
What were your students like?
I prefer to teach children. So like 90% of our students were kids.
Right.
So young children from about age of 4 to, we taught all ages, but 90% were like from 4 to elementary age.
And did you ever have to deal with any of these so-called monster parents that I've heard about?
To a degree, right? And basically, like, as a school owner, we just say, these are our system. If you want to follow it. If not, please don't study here anymore. So we had to fire a few parents, basically. But,
what were their complaints about?
Not so much complaints. It's you get different groups of people and you sell one service. Like, some parents want their kids only to play. And some kids want their kids to study all the time and learn, right? And it has to be some kind of balance in the middle. You can't be dictatorial and have study, 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 right? And at the same time, you can't just have kids playing on an Xbox all class, right? You have to teach them something, or they're not going to stick around. So you have to have make the classes fun.
Right.
And so a lot of parents don't like fun classes because they think that's not learning, even though I think fun classes are a more effective way to learn languages.
Yeah, I agree with that there. I experienced that a little bit when I was teaching English in Bangkok, because some of the Japanese parents would want to sit in the class with me, you know, just teaching their kid one-on-one. And I always noticed that the child would be so nervous about making a mistake or anything that I always asked the parent to leave. And as soon as the parent would leave, the child could relax and the lesson would always go much smoother.
Yeah, because we taught from such a young age and we've seen many kids grow up, we could even see the change in personalities of kids. Like, kids that were super outgoing when they're 3 or 4 years old just get it hammered out of them by the time they're 10 or 12 years old. It's kind of sad to see in many cases.
In Japan, they seem to go from this young, outgoing type of personality, and then suddenly overnight it kind of switches to this, you know, robotic, join the company, join the group, don't stand out kind of thinking.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad to see. So you ran your business for 10 years. And what would you say to someone now? Do you think someone now, if they're thinking about going abroad to teach English, say in Japan or in other countries, is this something you would recommend?
Well, I think there's two questions in there. One is it a good idea to leave your country to go and live abroad? I would say definitely yes. Travel opens you up to so many new ideas and cultures, and it's just so personally rewarding. So definitely I would recommend everyone, at least for a year, spend a year abroad at minimum. If you can do more, then definitely move abroad. And as far as being able to move abroad for a year or longer, teaching English is definitely the easiest and fastest way you can do that. I've written blog posts about that many times. It's the fastest way to reset your life in a foreign country, because basically you can get a job lined up for you, and you can get someone to find an apartment for you and get everything set up for you and earn a livable salary. Different countries pay different wages. So Japan is on the high side, so you can actually save a lot of money. And some other countries like Thailand, where you lived, maybe you're just getting by, but you can still get by, which is good in a foreign country indefinitely, right?
Right.
So I would definitely recommend it. Like, it, sometimes it can get monotonous because like, you're teaching beginner level students for a long time and it's the same kind of conversations over and over and over again.
Right.
So I think that's the drawback with teaching is like experienced teachers, after you've been doing that for 3 or 4 years, it starts getting pretty monotonous. It's the same type of conversations like, hello, how are you? I'm fine. Thank you. And you start hearing those same things right. over and over and over again. And it can drive you nuts if you don't find creative ways to spice up your classes. So definitely on both counts, move abroad and teach English. Those are, if you have a better way to make money, then do that. But if you need to make money and you need a visa to live abroad like you do in most countries, then teaching English is a fantastic way to do it.
Yeah, I never realized how important and how grateful I am that I'm a native English speaker until I moved abroad. You know, living in Canada and going to school, I never really thought about it. But once I started living overseas, I really realized how lucky I am. And especially when I started teaching English, I realized how hard it is to learn this language. I'm really glad I learned it as a kid before I realized how hard it was.
Right, yeah. Well, learning a foreign language is difficult in, I think, almost every language. Some might be easier to learn than others, but it is hard to learn a foreign language. It takes a lot of work and a lot of effort, that's for sure.
For sure. So after running your business for 10 years, you made a rather difficult decision to sell your business, correct? And what was your next goal after that?
Well, we didn't really have a goal. Basically, like we were teaching and things are going really good. When we started, we basically invested everything we had into getting a location. And we worked our asses off just to try to get clientele and get customers. And it took like a month or 2 months. And we were actually breaking even very, very quickly. I think even the first month, we were breaking even after the first month because students in Japan pay in advance.
Right.
So things worked out great. And like every month, our sales increased. And then like with more income came more expenditures. And so we bought like a house and we bought a nice car and then a new car and then stereos and we're eating out all the time and drinking expensive whiskey and wine. And then our lives just started stagnating. It was all about the consumption and not about building anything.
Right.
So that's where it really kind of it just got monotonous, basically. We're doing the same thing, and it just didn't seem like – in the beginning, it was so exciting because we're building new things, and I started some websites to teach children English through Flash Games, and we were doing many cool projects on the side. I hired different artists and designers and developers, and it looked like we had a lot of potential to do a lot of stuff. But then I just got burnt out from the monotony of it all and just kind of like living for – to make a little bit more money, just got too much, basically. So my wife and I, for the longest time, were just saying, okay, we got to leave. We got to stop this. We got to do something different. And then it's just so hard to give up. You have those golden handcuffs that you get a good salary every month, and you can buy whatever you want, do whatever you want, and have lots of free time. So it's hard to give that up for something unknown and uncertain.
It is, isn't it?
It's very, very hard. And so, but basically we said, like, if we don't change our life, we're going to be doing this until we retire, right? And then how many sacrifices does that mean we're going to make? All our dreams, all the things we wanted to do, travel the world, blah, blah, blah. All those kind of things. I think we would have many regrets if we didn't give that stuff up. So basically the final draw was like, I started my Jet Set Citizen blog, and a few months later, I finally said, okay, enough's enough. And I made a post and I said, in 1 year, we're going to sell everything. We're going to sell our business, sell our house, sell our car. We're going to change careers. We're going to change countries, and we're going to completely reinvent our lives, basically. So that's where that came from.
And when you made this blog post, did you have a step two lined up? Did you have another career, another job, another country already lined up?
No, we had nothing. I just needed some kind of commitment that would force me to start putting those steps into action.
Right.
We had nothing. I just made the call and said, like, this is it. Like, I've been putting this off for too long, right? And so, like, I'm going to make this commitment to everybody right now. It's going to be 1 year. We're going to do it. And we did it. We actually were a couple months ahead of schedule, actually. Things just started falling into place once we made that commitment.
Yeah, it's very interesting how when you start a business, you always have these dreams of what it's like when it's going to be successful. You know, you're kind of like, yeah, when I start making some money, I'll buy this car and I'll get this. And because you're struggling so much when you get it going. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. Even if you're in a job, you're like, oh, when I get the raise, when I get the bonus, I'll be able to do this. But then when you reach that level and your business is successful, like you said, it actually can become a bit monotonous. And you kind of miss the early days of being an entrepreneur and and, you know, struggling to get it going.
That's exactly right. Like, I tell this story over and over again. And basically, like, the best times in my life were the ones where I had the least amount of money and the least amount of possessions, and I was working the hardest to try to accomplish something.
Right.
Those are the times in my life where even my wife and I talk back and look, like, we have old pictures of our school where basically had barely no furniture in there because we couldn't afford to buy furniture for the school yet. And I made like a divider wall from an outdoor fence I bought at a hardware store in Japan. And we just did really, really everything super, super cheap. We, like, for our initial flyers, my wife at her last job, she kind of photocopied things and snuck photocopies out to, and we hand delivered the flyers to get customers, right? We did everything super cheap, maybe a little illegal.
Right.
And also, did it all by ourselves, right? And like, that was so rewarding because you can see the direct reward for that. But after a certain time, you're thinking, oh, like, another class, I don't want to teach anymore. Let's cancel this class, right? Like, oh, let's take more time off. And like we were working like 6 days a week for 50 weeks a year for the longest time. And then in the end, I was working like, what, 20 hours a week, and we had like 12 weeks vacation a year, and it was still too much for me.
Yeah, I think that if you've never started a business, you're really missing out on kind of the fun of being able to look back on the early struggling days. When you're in that period, it sucks, but when you can look back on it later on, it can be, like you said, a very rewarding experience. And my personal experience is that the rewards you get from the early startup days, the struggling days, are more than the financial or material rewards you get later on. You know what I mean? Like, okay, so now your business is doing well, you got some money, you buy a new car, you buy this, whatever. But to me, those kinds of things were never as rewarding as figuring out, like, how to build a divider with limited money or sneaking some photocopies out.
Exactly. I agree. Absolutely. That's completely true. It's like, one example that I often give is like, if you could get a helicopter ride to the top of Mount Everest, you're not going to have the same satisfaction as someone that spent the last 3 weeks climbing up and acclimatizing at each base camp and going through near-death experiences and experiencing all the weather trauma and everything, right? It's that getting through those difficult times that actually makes those things so satisfying.
Right.
Just the accomplishment means nothing, right? Anybody can buy an experience now, right? But actually working towards it, that's where the real satisfaction comes from in my mind.
Yeah, I totally agree. However, though, on the flip side, and you and I both have experienced this, is that once you've reached that level, once you've made your business a success and you've overcome all the hurdles, it can become, like a prison. Because in your mind, you're thinking, why would I ever leave this business? I spent 10 years building it. It's successful now. I don't have plan B lined up. I'd be crazy to leave this business.
You'd be crazy to leave it if the only thing you value is the money coming in.
Right.
But I think it's the only sane decision if you feel like you're missing something in your life and that you want another challenge, that you want to do something different, or you want to pursue a hobby or a dream. I think it's very important to kind of, we only have one life and it's very, very short, right? We could die tomorrow or get sick tomorrow, right? So if we're not living our dreams today and doing the things we want to do, then it's not worth it in the end, I think.
Was it a tough decision for you and your wife to sell your business?
Well, like I said, we're hesitating to do it for like years, right? So obviously it was difficult because like we're like, well, what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? How are we going to earn the money, right? We had all these worries in our head, right? But at the same time, those things just kept building and building and building, and finally said, okay, screw it. Like, in 1 year, we're going to leave. We have to make a decision or we're never going to do it, right?
Yeah, I think that I was in the same boat. I had my business for 10 years, and for the last 2 years of it, I tried to hire managers to run it, and it was a disaster. I lost lots of money, and then finally I made the decision to sell it. I really didn't want to sell it because it was a good business. I enjoyed doing it, but it limited my options as to what else I could do in my life. And then when I made the decision to sell it, I believe I found a buyer in May. I trained him in June and July, and I was in Thailand in October.
Awesome.
So within 6 months, Everything of mine was in storage. I'd never been to Thailand before. I never took a holiday. You can, right? So suddenly, boom, I got all this free time and I'm in a totally different country. But I think making that first critical decision, like you did on your website with your, you know, 1 year plan to start a new career and a new life, really gets the ball rolling. Even if it's just mental, it gets the ball rolling.
If I didn't do that blog post, most likely I would still be doing that same work today and still be regretting not doing anything else with my life.
So tell us about your website. It's called jetsetcitizen.com. And you interview other people who are living kind of a location independent lifestyle. Is that right?
Yeah. So basically I try to find long-term travelers or expats and just find out what their life is like. But mainly what I want to get is information on how they're able to fund their lifestyle and their living costs to try to get some real details.
Right.
A lot of people try to glamorize this life. It's like you're living like on yachts and flying around jets. So jet set is a little bit of a misnomer because I'm not advocating like living the high life.
Right.
It's more like being a global citizen. That's the real meaning of it. It's not traveling around in first class and staying at five-star hotels or anything like that. It's just about being a global citizen.
Right.
So there's tons of people out there that are actually that have this life, and that was the big surprise for me when I started blogging. I started connecting with all these people online, and I found like hold on, this is not as scary as I thought it was, because there's thousands of people that are doing this, and people have been doing it long before the internet and blogs were popular, right? So it's certainly not impossible, and it's actually much, much easier than most people think. So I started interviewing these people and talking to them and finding out how they do it. And it just became like a little bit more motivation for me to get out and do it. And as well, I really wanted to learn like really how much does it cost for you to live there and how are you earning your income? Do you have rich parents or do you do this? And some people are. They blog like they built a business and they're so successful. But in actuality, they're staying at their parents' bungalow in Thailand or Costa Rica or something, right? So some people have different advantages that other people don't. So I just want to kind of squeeze that kind of information out of people and find out really where do they get their money from? How are they earning their living? How do they go from working in a job back home and then finally living abroad and kind of making money online? So I just try to ask the hard questions, and sometimes people don't answer, but recently I've been getting more lucky because people have been giving me those details.
Yeah, those details, I think, for some people, they're hesitant to release. Thailand and especially Bangkok is a very, city popular with these type of people because it's a good hub for Southeast Asia. So we get people coming through Bangkok quite a bit. And, many times I would read their website and, the reality of their lifestyle in Bangkok was not really reflected on what I saw on their website. You know, they would advertise that they're living this, you know, high society lifestyle. And then I would look at their apartment is like, you know, a $150 cockroach infested apartment.
Yeah.
But the thing is, with the internet, you can make anything look real. So for someone who's looking to kind of maybe make a transition in their life, I think getting all the nitty gritty details of exactly what it costs to live in these various different countries is vital.
And that's the purpose of my, like, you can teach English and as well as Jet Set Citizen. Like, if anybody reads my personal posts, I think I try to be very, very honest. I'm not glamorizing this life. I'm not saying that it's easy to make tons of money. Like, so it's not like get rich quick kind of information that a lot of people seem to be selling with their $97 ebooks and membership programs. So I really want to put an honest view out there. And that's what I try to get out of the interviews, is that there are a lot of people doing it, but it's not like an easy lifestyle by any stretch of the imagination. And a lot of people get sick of traveling. Like my wife and I actually hate traveling. We love living in other countries, but we hate the process of traveling and looking for a new place and getting a new apartment and learning the transportation system and finding good places to eat and doing all that stuff. Like we like some routine in our lives, right? So travel itself is nice if you do it 2 months of a year and you go to, or 2 weeks of a year and you go to a nice resort and everything's taken care of for you. But if you have to go and organize that stuff for yourself every couple of weeks, but by changing a country, it can turn into a pain very, very quickly. And so like I'm married and I'm a little bit older. So like my kind of idea of travel and living abroad is probably different than like a 22-year-old that's just going for like 3 months or 6 months after university before they get a real career.
Right.
So yeah, so definitely, so the people I interview, I want to interview people that are really living the lifestyle, not people that just went abroad for a couple months and partied all the time. They're going to go back and live in their parents' place and start a career a few months later, right?
So let me ask you then, for you, after living in one area for 14 years and now you've been on the road for a while, what has been the biggest reward for you about living abroad?
Well, the biggest thing is we're not tied to a schedule or a business now. So we have complete freedom of our time. We can go whenever we want, wake up whenever we want, do whatever we want, travel wherever we want. Basically, we have 100% freedom, and it's very liberating.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's easy to get caught up in doing nothing all day. We buy gym memberships usually when we go to a place for a long time, and we work out for 2 or 3 hours a day and walk around and hang around cafes. So we do a lot of fun stuff too. And so I'm not getting so much accomplished anymore actually, because our life is so unstructured.
Right.
So, but the rewarding part is just having complete freedom and no stress. Making lots of money is nice, but then you're kind of, you start competing for your next possession and you want your new car and you want to impress everybody with your new 60-inch TV and you go out to fancy restaurants and your $60 bottle of wine and stuff. And so your life is about working lots so you can consume lots. But now that we don't work anymore, well, we work very little now. So our life, we try to put artificial constraints in our life, for just not consuming very much. So we have that kind of same feeling that we did when we were young and starting out and didn't have so much money and we're working hard towards something.
Right.
But now we're not so much working hard towards something. We're just enjoying our life and doing things that are valuable. For example, we'll cook most of our meals now and spend a lot of time doing it just because the processes of actually cooking food is enjoyable. And we like eating fresh, unprocessed food, and that's healthy for you and tastes better and you enjoy it more because you cooked it and made it yourself. We like going to the gym rather than watching TV. We like going, we don't have cars. We don't rent cars or anything when we go places because we actually enjoy the process of for example, riding bicycles and taking the bus so you can have that downtime and do stuff for yourself.
Yeah, that's the key word you said there. It's kind of funny that once you lose your business and once you kind of get rid of that, the constraints, You look for downtime. Whereas when I was running my business, I never looked for downtime. I always try to maximize everything I did. You know, I would never cook. I would just always eat at a restaurant because it was faster.
Yeah.
And then if I did take a brief holiday somewhere, I'd rent a car and I'd make a list of things I wanted to see and drive around, take pictures and then go back. But once you kind of get rid of those constraints, you really realize that, you can take a lot more joy in kind of the simpler things. Like cooking or riding a bike or just walking around a new neighborhood and talking to the people there.
Exactly. I think all of us trade time for money in different parts of our life. Like when we're students, maybe we have more time than we have money, but actually after you start getting your career and a family and a house, then you start having more money than you do time.
Right.
So, the key is finding the right balance for yourself. And for my wife and I, it's money is not so important to us anymore. We had those things and they didn't make us happy. So a bigger house or a fancier car or more expensive restaurants didn't actually make us happy. They just add to your stress level and that kind of keeping up with the Joneses and trying to impress your friends with your latest purchase and stuff. So it's hard to get out of that consumption cycle. But if you do, I think it's very rewarding because you can actually value your time and things, just spending time with friends and new people you meet, going to couch surfing meetings around the world and meeting fellow travelers and people are not into that kind of materialism and consumerism that seems so prevalent around the world.
Right.
So there are a lot of cool people if you kind of get out of that kind of career focused lifestyle.
Right. Right.
And at the same time, you can do good things. We do more volunteer work now and we're kind of, there's not so much pressure to earn lots of money. So the websites I work on, it doesn't matter if they make money or not. I'm doing it more because I enjoy doing it.
Right.
And so, most of all, there's a lot more freedom. It's like, for example, we last year we lived a couple months in Budapest and we lived a couple months in Istanbul and we traveled around Europe and we're going to go to Asia again very soon. And so just having that freedom to do it for a couple months rather than going for a 10-day vacation like most people do, right? It's a very different experience when you actually rent an apartment and live like a local for a little while and find your regular cafes or regular grocery stores that you can repeatedly go to and find some cool bars to listen to some live music. It's a very, very different experience than just going there for 10 days and doing the touristy things.
So you mentioned that you are coming back to Asia. Do you have plans to move back to Japan?
Well, I don't know, move back so yet. Like, we definitely love Japan and we miss Japan a lot. Like, the food is fantastic. The culture is fantastic. The history is fantastic. The people are fantastic. So in many ways, I really, really miss Japan. And I know my wife does too, because she's Japanese, of course.
Right.
But at the same time, it's kind of cool to travel and do different things. Like, maybe we would return and live there for like 6 months of the year or something, and then and use it as a home base or something. That might happen in the next 5 years or so. But not in the next year. We'll visit in the next year, but we won't move back in the next year anyways. That's as far as we know right now, I think.
Oh, that's great. If people want to find out more information about your websites, if you're interested in teaching English around the world, you can visit youcanteachenglish.com, where you've got job listings and information about visas and all sorts of stuff about finding English teaching jobs around the world. And if you are thinking about making the jump away from your 9-to-5 life, and I think John and I both highly recommend it, visit jetsetcitizen.com and you can check out all of his interviews with other people who are living independent location lifestyles around the world. Thanks, John. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Anthony. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to John Bardo for coming on the show, and I would definitely recommend checking out his websites if you're interested in teaching English around the world or just trying to figure out how you can break free from your 9-to-5 job. Nothing wrong with having a 9-to-5 job and nothing wrong with having a business, but I think him and I would both agree that you really do miss out a lot when you stay and do anything for any length of time. You know, if you stay and do something for long periods of time, it's great, but you're also missing out a lot, and I think one of the hardest things to do is break free from something you've been doing a long time. You know, that old cliche saying, get out of your comfort zone. But if you can do that and you can hit on the road, I think it does give you a lot of rewards that you won't regret later on in your life. Join me next week when I have a very special interview with a gentleman named Isaku Kageyama. And if you know the name, you know what this show is going to be about. Isaku is one of the premier young taiko drummers of his generation. He's won a couple competitions, championship competitions, and he is the first taiko drummer to be accepted at a major American musical university. So this should be a lot of fun. I really enjoy watching taiko because the drum and the performance are so powerful, and Isaku is one of the best at it, so I'm really looking forward to this. Don't forget, everyone, that if you got a moment, I'd really appreciate if you could go into your iTunes application and go to the iTunes store and find Tokyo Podcast and give me a feedback or even just a star rating. It really does help with my ranking so that when people search for Tokyo Podcast, I'm not like on page 147 or something like that. If you do that for me, I'll be pushed a little bit further to the top. So if you got a moment, I really appreciate that. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.